and, you know, it got all into personhood. And I think the cognitive dissonance is enraging, that, you know, I have interviewed this woman who has children, and to talk about her beliefs on reproductive health, and, you know, she is insistent that life begins at conception, and I don't understand how these folks are pushing to have their cake and eat it too, in saying that, you know, these embryos, which weren't even referenced in the bill, like you said, are humans, while any other reproductive health choice, including abortion and miscarriage, could be affected by Alabama's current laws on abortion.
Finally, Abby, you wrote in Glamour, I want people reading this who don't live in Alabama to know that you're not special and you are not safe. We're going to begin part two of our conversation and put it online with that point. Abby Crane is based in Alabama in Birmingham. She's a journalist and artist with Reckon. She's been undergoing IVF treatments for nearly 2 years. She just met with Vice President Kamala Harris. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back with her online.
KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations of programming of KABU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kabu.fm. The Program Advisory Committee meets quarterly on the first Tuesday of March, June, September, and December at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kabu.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
You're listening to KBOO, All Thrills, No Frills, Volume 3, Special Programming Campaign. Check out all the great special programs we're bringing you in February and March at kabu.fm/thrills. Help us reach our goal of $22,000 by March 16th. You can go to kboo.fm/give or text us. Type in KBOO to the number 44321. The number again is 44321. For the thrill of it all, keep listening.
This is KBOO Portland. Special thanks to the recent donors to our All Thrills, No Frills special programming campaign. Thank you to Nancy G., James B., Michael A., and two anonymous donors. Be like these fine people and support your community radio station with a donation at kboo.fm. Now, your KABU Evening News.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KABU Evening News.
Coming up on the KABU Evening News, the emergency housing package passes the Oregon legislature, Portlanders rally for a ceasefire in Gaza this weekend, and in national news, Californians push back on robo-taxis. Good evening. This is the KABU Evening News for Monday, March 4th, 2024. I'm Reed Johnson. Oregon lawmakers passed the Emergency Housing Stability and Production Package today, sending $376 million in investment to the governor's desk for signature. The package does a few things to address Oregon's housing scarcity and affordability problem. It allows cities a one-time expansion of their urban growth boundaries, and a third of housing built in the expanded areas must be affordable. Senate Bill 1530 makes major investments in shelter projects, recovery housing, and affordable housing construction. Investments in these total $123 million. It includes some $30 million for projects in under-resourced communities, like the Albina Fission Trust's plan to redevelop Portland Public Schools headquarters into affordable housing. The emergency housing package also allocates money towards healthy and safe homes, with funds for projects lowering energy costs and making homes safer. $131 million were allocated to building pathways to housing, like emergency shelters, eviction prevention, and recovery housing. The Oregon Senate passed the bills on February 29th, and the House passed the bills earlier today. Thousands marched in Portland on Saturday, calling for an immediate and permanent ceasefire in Gaza. Protesters congregated on the Hawthorne Bridge, shutting down traffic. They joined cities around the world on an International Day of Action for Palestine under the unifying messages of Ceasefire Now and Hands Off Rafah. Saturday marked a week before Israel's scheduled invasion of the southern Gaza city of Rafah. Rafah was formally listed as a safe area by the Israeli military for refugees to flee to. It is now the next target in the military's ground offensive through the occupied territory. Millions collectively are estimated to have been involved in the protest actions in cities across the globe. The Multnomah County Commissioners will finally vote on a Gaza ceasefire resolution on Thursday. The resolution calls for a, quote, immediate negotiated ceasefire while acknowledging, quote, the local impact of global events on our communities. The past few months have seen dozens of ceasefire resolutions passed by city and county bodies across the United States. Commissioner Lori Stegman initiated a resolution borrowing extensively from a draft sent to the board by pro-Palestine organizations like Jewish Voices for Peace, PDX, and the Oregon to Palestine Coalition. The draft included a call for an immediate and permanent ceasefire while also asking the county board to recognize the historical context of Israel and Palestine's relationship prior to Hamas's October 7th attack. Stegman's staff acknowledges that the resolution currently on the agenda is less specific than the original proposal. They also noted the difficulty of getting unanimous board approval on an ideal resolution. Maxine Fuchsen is a member of Jewish Voices for Peace, PDX, who worked on the resolution. Speaking with the Portland Mercury, she voiced her disappointment with the resolution's failure to hold Israel accountable. She acknowledged, nonetheless, the importance of passing such a resolution, saying, quote, is it good? No, it's not good at all. It's embarrassingly bad. I'm hopeful we'll get some changes and improvements to it. But I want to see every location in the world making ceasefire resolutions because something needs to be lifted up to the Biden administration to say, you have to call for a ceasefire, end quote. In national news, Nikki Haley says she may not endorse the GOP nominee. President Biden says the U.S. will continue to airdrop aid into Gaza, and more states look at ditching the Electoral College for a national popular vote. With more on the story, it's Catherine Carley with 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
We had thousands of people in Virginia. We're headed to North Carolina. We're going to continue to go to Vermont and Maine and all these states to go and show people that there is a path forward.
Continuing with her presidential campaign ahead of Super Tuesday, Nikki Haley tells NBC she's no longer bound by a pledge to support the eventual Republican nominee. Haley says she's always had serious concerns about former President Donald Trump. Over the weekend, Trump won caucuses in Idaho and Missouri. A New York Times Siena College poll says he has a narrow lead over President Joe Biden, in part because of doubts about Biden's age. 16 states hold primaries tomorrow, including the battleground of North Carolina, where civil rights advocates worry a new voter ID rule could disenfranchise minority and low-income residents. And Bob Phillips with Common Cause says another law eliminates a previous 3-day grace period for mail-in ballots.
No one wants to see someone who is a legally, properly registered voter that does the right thing, and just because it gets lost in the mail, that their vote doesn't count.
The Supreme Court could issue a decision today on whether Donald Trump can be removed from Colorado's ballot for leading the January 6th insurrection. President Biden says the U.S. will continue airdropping humanitarian aid into Gaza after Israeli soldiers killed more than 100 desperate Palestinians who had rushed a food convoy.
Innocent lives are on the line and children's lives are on the line. We should be getting hundreds of trucks in, not just several.
A White House source Saturday said Israel had more or less agreed to a six-week ceasefire. But yesterday, the Jerusalem Post called the deal close to collapse over Israel's demand for the names of all living hostages. A federal judge has temporarily blocked a Texas law letting the state arrest and deport people who enter the United States illegally. Adriana Pinon with the ACLU says the law would allow deportation based only on probable cause without even a trial.
Everybody deserves to be able to avail themselves of the protection of the Constitution and the federal laws.
Several state legislatures are considering bills to replace the Electoral College with a national popular vote. The states would agree to cast their electors for the popular vote winner once enough states to decide the election have joined the system. At present, about three-quarters of the states needed are in. Former Vermont Congressman Chris Pearson says every vote in every state should count equally.
I think this will bolster confidence in the system and have an impact down ballot and generally give Americans a better sense of ownership over our democracy.
A Washington Post analysis says with the current Electoral College system, under 1 in 5 Americans, those in battleground states, will cast decisive votes for president, a record low. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
A bill to grant local cities the ability to regulate autonomous vehicles is getting a lot more attention after the California Public Utilities Commission decided on Friday to allow robo-taxis on Los Angeles and San Francisco freeways. The CPUC granted the company Waymo's driverless taxi service permission to drive up to 65 miles per hour. Teamsters Joint Council 42 President Chris Griswold represents truck drivers and says he supports Senate Bill 915 over concerns about autonomous vehicles' safety record.
These vehicles are just stopping for no reason. We've had emergency vehicles blocked. You've had animals run over. You had a lady drugged down the street. We can't trust these companies to just be out in the streets and run wild. We have to have our community leaders regulating these vehicles.
In October, the California Department of Motor Vehicles revoked the operating permit of the company Cruise, which is backed by General Motors, following an investigation after a pedestrian was dragged 20 feet. Waymo is backed by Google and said in a statement that the company has, quote, no immediate plans to put its driverless vehicles on the highways and will take a, quote unquote, careful and incremental approach to expansion. L.A. County Supervisor Janice Hahn, in a statement, said Angelenos shouldn't be big tech's guinea pigs and declared support for the bill to allow local control. The bill's author, State Senator David Cortese, says SB 915 would allow cities and counties to regulate autonomous vehicles in the same way they set the rules for traditional taxis right now, but he's not calling for a ban.
The bill will not allow the ban of AVs or robo-taxis. We will ensure every step of the way that the bill embraces the innovation, but at the same time, make sure that we're in a position to make it as safe as possible.
The bill is currently awaiting consideration in the state Senate committees on local government and on transportation. In local news, Portland Street Response could be moving out of the city's Fire Bureau and into the Community Safety Division. The program sends teams of mental health professionals and EMTs to help people in behavioral health crises, and it's a popular program with measured success. But since Commissioner Rene Gonzalez took over the Fire Bureau, the future for the program has been uncertain. He barred the teams from distributing tents and required them to be present at camp sweeps. The program was scheduled to go 24 hours a day citywide by early 2023, but that change failed to materialize, costing the program federal Medicaid funds. Now, through the city budget process, Commissioner Gonzalez wants to dump street response from his portfolio, something Mayor Ted Wheeler would take on instead. Street Roots Executive Director Kaya Sand told Oregon Live, quote, "I'm really optimistic about this direction." She helped to launch the group Friends of Portland Street Response last year. One of the group's demands is to establish Street Response as a co-equal branch of the First Responder Network in a supportive environment. Part of the shift is due to a budget shortfall at the Fire Bureau and that Street Response doesn't have a permanent funding source. It's supported by one-time American Rescue Plan dollars and money from the general fund. Staffers at the mayor's office have indicated he plans to prioritize funding the program this budget cycle. The Chinook Indian Nation is close to federal recognition. Compensation for land that was taken from the nation during the colonization of what is now Washington State will finally no longer be withheld. That's according to an announcement last Thursday. The Chinook Indian Nation encompasses all five nations that historically lived along the Lower Columbia River. The decision to compensate the Chinook was made over 50 years ago. In August 1970, the Indian Claims Commission awarded the lower band of Chinook and Clatsop $48,000 for lands taken during colonization. In the decision, known as Docket 234, the commission acknowledged the lower Chinook and Clatsop people's claim to their ancestral lands. Since then, however, these funds have been withheld from the nation by the Bureau of Indian Affairs, or BIA. Their reasoning? The Chinook Indian Nation was not a federally recognized nation and could not lay claim to the settlements. In 2001, the U.S. government acknowledged the Chinook as a sovereign nation, but then only 18 months later, they rescinded the federal recognition without paying the tribe what they owed. The Chinook eventually sued the government for federal recognition in 2017. The judge in the lawsuit ruled in the Chinook's favor. Since then, the nation has developed a use and distribution plan for the funds, which has been approved by both the BIA and the Secretary of Interior. Last December, the Chinook received word they will gain unrestricted access to the funds, which have sat in the government trust account since the 1970 decision. They now amount to over $686,000. Chinook leadership see the decision as a symbolic victory. Tony Johnson is the chairman of the Chinook Indian Nation. He said, quote, "This Docket 234 decision is not the formal federal recognition that we're seeking, but it is unambiguous recognition of our community's existence and of our rightful land title to the lands where we continue to live," end quote. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Making Contact, the Feminist Birth of the Home Pregnancy Test. At 6 p.m., it's Labor Radio. Then at 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. And then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with a low of 34. Tomorrow's weather will be partly sunny with a high of 48. Today in history, in 1933, Frances Perkins becomes U.S. Secretary of Labor under President Franklin Roosevelt. She was the first female member of the U.S. cabinet. And our quote of the day is from American author Julia Cameron, who wrote, quote, "Perfectionism is not a quest for the best. It is a pursuit of the worst in ourselves, the part that tells us that nothing we will do will ever be good enough. We shouldn't try again. No, we should not. Focused on process, our creative life retains a sense of adventure. Focused on product, the same creative life can feel foolish or barren." City Commissioners Dan Ryan and Renee Gonzalez are concerned about the potential bias of voter outreach groups hired to educate Portlanders about the new city government, Willamette Week reports. Both men are running in the next election, Gonzalez for mayor and Ryan for a council seat. The upcoming November election will be the first to incorporate ranked choice voting, a system that allows people to vote for multiple candidates in order of preference. Last fall, the city of Portland approved funds for a voter education and outreach initiative that will be administered by United Way of the Columbia Willamette. In all, United Way has around $200,000 to dole out to community groups that are well situated to reach historically disenfranchised groups and communities of color. Staff for Commissioners Gonzalez and Ryan have been sending emails back and forth with the city charter's transition team. They say that they're concerned that some groups might get funding who have both non-political and political tax classifications. They're demanding assurances that any group that conducts outreach with city money won't endorse any candidate for office this election. A closed-door meeting was held on Wednesday with the council staffers, the transition team, and the city auditor, who oversees city elections. The outcome of that meeting is not known. A new analysis shows that wildfires in the Pacific Northwest are going to spike in their frequency and intensity in the coming years. KBOO's Mattia Carlin has more on the story.
Forests in the coolest, wettest parts of the Pacific Northwest are likely to see big increases in fire size and burn probability as the climate gets warmer and drier. An Oregon State University scientist named Alex Dye with the U.S. Forest Service published a study on the future of fires in the Pacific Northwest. The research consisted of comprehensive wildfire simulations of more than 23 million acres of forest in the Cascade Range in Oregon and Washington. The study showed that beginning in 2035, this region could see at least twice as much fire as seen in the last 30 years. More frequent big fires could have major impacts, like the 2020 Labor Day fires. Big fires can impact important resources from drinking water to timber and put wildlife and local residents in danger. Dye says that while climate is just one factor influencing wildfires, it is a crucial one. He says it is time to start thinking about things that could counteract these climate effects. Dye sees the findings as crucial for planning to help the Northwest prepare for the acceleration of fire in the next few decades. Wildfire smoke can travel hundreds of thousands of miles, impacting city residents as well. For KBOO News, I'm Mattia Carlin.
A farm advocacy group says large corporate agricultural producers are getting federal environmental safeguard funds that were intended for smaller operations. The Inflation Reduction Act has provided $3 billion for conservation programs designed to shore up farm-related environmental safeguards, many focused on concentrated animal feeding operations, or CAFOs. Farm Action President Angela Huffman says a recent shift in Biden administration policy has allowed money intended for small or medium-sized farmers, who've often been underserved by USDA policies, to wind up in the hands of corporate CAFOs.
They're already raking in a lot of taxpayer-funded subsidies, so we're really urging USDA to reconsider this recent decision.
Large-scale ag operators say they also are looking for ways to be more environmentally friendly while meeting growing consumer demand for safe, high-quality foods. Huffman says large ag operations have gotten money to process liquid waste from manure lagoons and to install anaerobic digesters, which remove methane from manure that corporations then sell as an energy source. Huffman says neither was intended to be paid for by the Inflation Reduction Act. She adds a recent letter from Congress has asked the agency to reverse course.
Congress authorized USDA to spend these funds to help smaller and mid-sized producers implement conservation practices, and that's what the USDA should be doing.
That letter went to Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack, former governor of Iowa, the nation's largest hog producer and home to almost 4,000 CAFOs. That's the most in the nation, by a factor of more than 3.5. Native tribes and allies are considering their next steps for protecting Oak Flat in Arizona. That's because a recent Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals ruling said the federal government can transfer the sacred site to a foreign-owned mining company. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Apache Stronghold, a coalition of Apache people, other Native people, and non-Native allies, is vowing to continue to fight to protect a sacred site in Arizona. This after a federal court blow to the group's effort to protect Oak Flat from mining. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled 6-5 in Apache Stronghold versus United States that the federal government can transfer Oak Flat to Resolution Copper, a foreign-owned mining company. The group hoped to stop the copper mine project by preventing the federal government from transferring the land, saying the project violates religious freedom, the sites where Apache religious practices take place. In a statement after the decision Friday, Dr. Winsler Nosey of the Apache Stronghold said the ruling targets the spiritual lifeblood of his people, but said it will not stop their struggle to save Oak Flat, and he vowed to appeal to the Supreme Court. The lawsuit was filed in 2021. The Ninth Circuit ruled the mine is not subject to federal laws protecting religious freedom. Beckett Law Firm, which represents Apache Stronghold Gold said the decision was by a bare majority, with five judges disagreeing, saying the decision misreads precedent and uniquely harms Native American religious exercise. In a statement, Resolution Copper welcomed the ruling and said the project is expected to supply copper to the U.S., create jobs, and boost Arizona's economy. Apache Stronghold has 90 days to appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. The Eastern Shoshone tribe has received 10 bison from Yellowstone National Park. Wyoming Public Radio's Olivia Wheats reports for the Mountain West News Bureau.
The Eastern Shoshone tribe received a family group from the Bison Conservation Transfer Program. Since the transfer program got started in 2019, the tribe has received a total of 15 Yellowstone bison. Eastern Shoshone tribal member Jason Baldess manages the tribe's herd.
Plans are to continue to grow the population and change land use so that they have a place to exist and are protected under tribal law. This is a batch of animals that's very important because of their genetics and their lineage and descendancy.
Baldus says the tribe's herd size is now 98 animals, with bison also coming from other sources besides Yellowstone. I'm Olivia Wheats at the Center of the West in Cody.
Bloom Communications in Alaska is helping companies that want to work with indigenous communities through understanding cultural differences, bridging gaps, and collaboration. KMBA's Hannah Bissett has more about culture camps recently started in Anchorage and Fairbanks.
Based in Fairbanks, Bloom Communications was founded 5 years ago by Charlene Osbloom.
The misunderstandings and really lack of knowledge from non-Native people about Alaska Native people, cultures, what life is like in rural Alaska. And therefore, I created the corporate culture camps.
She says the camps could aid businesses in understanding the cultural nuances and norms one might expect in indigenous communities in Alaska. The workshop also emphasized education in complex networks of corporations and businesses that impact Alaska Native people. The training centers on the history, geographical locations, and their impacts on subsistence. The training is in person in 2 days in total. Osbloom says it's also important to understand communication challenges in rural communities.
You may not always get someone on the phone because sometimes the phones don't work out in rural Alaska. If you're wanting to send a large document to someone by email, they may or may not receive it because of the amount of data that it takes.
Beyond the numbers, there's something more important for urban companies to understand.
Try to make positive, long-lasting connections with Alaska Native people and, you know, different organizations, and to do so in a respectful and collaborative manner.
I'm Hannah Bissett.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Even though March is barely underway, parents are being encouraged to plan for their kids' summer reading activities, especially if their child needs more skills and confidence in reading. And there are tips for adults, too. Mike Moen has more in Wisconsin.
It's National Reading Month, and schools are often tasked with helping students with literacy challenges, and there are dozens of community-based programs across the state. But Blaise Burton of the Mercer Public Library says parents can think about ways to also weave in a less formal approach. His location has a specific summer program that works to draw in kids who aren't exactly enthusiastic about picking up a book.
We give out these passports, and kids and adults can go to all the different libraries in our area and get a stamp, and then get entered into a drawing. And then you get the kids into the libraries, you get them a book in their hand, and you say, here, you can take this, and then just return it to the next one you go at.
He says combining accessibility with prize incentives might make reading feel less like a chore. And for adults who want to boost their literacy skills, Burton says trying nonfiction is a good option because the sentence structure tends to be straightforward. Burton says overall, sticking with topics you're interested in helps lay the groundwork for wanting to continue reading. For preteens, he says graphic novels can be a popular choice.
It is a lot of dialogue. Sometimes there's some context, you know, paragraphs and stuff in there, but it gives kids that visual, and sometimes they need that to keep going.
He says graphic novels often emphasize a singular word on the page, helping the child to better understand its meaning. And for those in their teen years, literacy experts say they can find books about the issues they're experiencing, potentially serving as sources of strength and encouragement. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, March 4th, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation.
Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Matea Carlin, Birdie, Jasmine, and myself. The producer and engineer is Althea Billings. Special thanks to Mike Moen, Mark Moran, Suzanne Potter, Catherine Carley, and Antonia Gonzalez. The director of Evening News is the radio regent herself, Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Reed Johnson. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members, lovely people like yourself. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Making Contact, and have a good night.
Making contact.
I'm Amy Gastelum. Today on Making Contact, we're bringing you the birth story of America's first home pregnancy test.
It was just amazing. I thought, well, how simple that would be. All you need is a test tube and a mirror. And and a woman could do it herself.
That's Margaret Crane. She goes by Meg. In 1965, she was a graphic designer, only 25 years old. At that tender age, she got it in her mind that instead of asking a doctor for a lab test, people could do pregnancy tests at home.
Just as a woman, I thought,